Welcome to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Now, Interstate Batteries has been a proud supporter of the Sportsman's Nation since day one. And if you guys need a special battery, whether it's a regular battery or something special that's very rare and hard to find, stop by your local Interstate Battery retail location and talk with a battery expert. These guys are very knowledgeable in the products that they sell, and they can get you what you want, when you want it, whether it's a truck battery, whether it's a special battery for like a rangefinder or trail camera batteries, any type of battery, these guys are able to get it for you. So stop into a Interstate Battery retail location, talk with a specialist, or if you want to learn about the culture, the company of Interstate Batteries, visit interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
All right, guys. You know what's fun about these podcasts, Matt? And I guess I should, before I jump into it, tell you guys that lots of consulting. I fly out to Pennsylvania tomorrow, which this podcast release. I'm on my way back from Pennsylvania, but flying to Pennsylvania. Matt's driving to Minnesota. Consulting full bore. So Matt's calling in, Chad's calling in, and so we've got a three-person phone call here, and so that's how we're going to do it this week. So we apologize if we jump in and talk over each other, because there is no ability to read body language here. and so Matt's calling in, Chad's calling in, and we're going to talk fire. I think fire, I don't know, it ranks way up there on the amount of questions we get when it comes to habitat management projects. I think because, you know, fire, there's so many different types of fires, so many different ways to use fire. A lot of guys who can't use fire haven't used fire, and they have a lot of questions about it. So we're going to be covering some of those things about fire, but specifically post-fire observations, what to expect, and different things like that. But, you know, the great thing, Matt, specifically, Chad, as well, with your job, but for Matt and I, every week we do two podcasts, and it's just because of the amount of content, and during hunting season we can cover different things. I don't know if we'll do two podcasts forever, but right now we've got so much content. And some weeks it's like, what can we do? What can we do? And it's like, why do we complicate things? Let's just record the conversations we have when we go to a farm and look things over, because really I think that can be most beneficial to people.
I definitely think so, and I think that it's super important to, as we're talking about fire, is not only observe what is there, but very critically, once you've done a disturbance, whether it's chainsaw, whether it's fire, I don't care what it is, herbicide application, you have to go back and observe what happens, because that's the gold. That's what's going to encourage you to continue and then learn from, maybe as we talked today, it's timing of a fire or intensity of a fire. You have to watch and learn how that disturbance either improved things, which most likely it did, but to what degree of improvement. So, I mean, we observe a lot as we walk around, drive around, see farms, but to me, this is like where the rubber meets the road of conversation and observation. How do we maybe improve on this technique or make it better for the next time, the next go around?
Absolutely. And you know, like I said, there's so many questions with fire. We use it quite a bit, as well as given the specific client that we're working with. A lot of them are encouraged to use fire or are already using fire, even when we show up. And so I think We talk a lot about fire being a reset button and having the ability to really bring that vegetation back if we need it to, put that vegetation in a more controlled state as far as height-wise and not being overgrown to where it may require mechanical use or mechanical management, various things. And so fire is, it's a natural disturbance as well in a lot of instances. And so for us, it's just, why not replicate nature? We talk about it so much. And, you know, and fire really fits into everyone's goals. You know, that's a big thing we ask our clients. What are your goals? What are you trying to achieve here? And for our goals, we're always trying to manage for a healthy landscape. And a healthy landscape creates a healthy game populations, healthy non-game populations. And overall, it's just a much more enjoyable thing to selfishly speaking, it's just a much more enjoyable place to be when you have a healthy landscape. And for us, we're managing for diversity, a healthy forest, whatever the specific site is, we just want it to be healthy. And so for us, we use fire in a way to just manage vegetation, really, and create
I think that's why there's so many questions about fires, because it's so documented how beneficial it can be on the landscape, and so many people want to do it. But it's also a very scary thing and a thing that can go drastically wrong.
Yes.
If you're not experienced and if you are not knowledgeable on what you're doing.
Absolutely.
You can mess a lot of things up with fire if you don't know what you're doing.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, kill trees, damage your neighbor's farm. Hopefully you don't ever deal with anything catastrophic, burn your barn down, burn your cabin down, things like that. But on the flip side of that, there really is, to my knowledge, unless there's a big void in my vision here, I'm not sure of something that you can use that manages more acres in a shorter window of time than prescribed fire.
There's really not. And I guess while we're talking relatively about the white elephant in the room is the risk with prescribed fire. And I think that that's the first thing that everyone naturally just in their mind gravitates to, which is responsible, and which we certainly encourage. You have to know what it is that you're dealing with and the intensity of that tool, let's say. But at the same time, when I think about prescribed fire, I also look and say, running a chainsaw, the last time I checked, wasn't the safest thing out there. You can kill trees with herbicide. You like accidentally. There's a lot of other tools out there that have other consequences that prescribed fire also has a consequence, let's say. So I know people are scared to use prescribed fire, but at the same time, every other management technique that we talk about and we cover that we promote has its risks, but don't be afraid to learn and study prescribed fire and implement it, even though it has risks. Everything that we do has risks, but just do it smart, do it wise, make sure you have a lot of people there, make sure you have the right tools and the right knowledge. And it's one of the best things, as you're saying, Adam, to be able to use and manage a ton of acres in an afternoon.
Absolutely.
And it's like once you get there, like once you get comfortable utilizing it and realizing it is just a tool, just like a chainsaw, just like a sprayer, just like a disc. Like once you realize that, you'll quickly become accustomed to like saying, hey, can I burn that? Can I do that? Can I use fire here? Can I use fire there? Just because it's so beneficial.
Yeah.
I think
it's one of those things too that, you know, I love the QDMA events for a lot of reasons and a lot of behind the scenes reasons why people just like the conversations we get to have with people like Kip and Lindsay and Matt and Joe and all the QDMA guys, but then people like Dr. Craig Harper. And, you know, we had a late night conversation at Whitetail Weekend where it was kind of the conversation. I think I asked Craig, I was like, all right, pick a tool. You only have one tool to manage this farm. what is it going to be? And I think he said he would take a drip torch over a chainsaw because he says, I can still kill, and I'll put my best North Carolina, I can still kill trees with a drip torch.
It's true. If that's what you're choosing to do, if that's the management that's needed, the right timing, the right conditions, it's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And let's face it. Natural fire before we suppressed it killed trees.
It did. It set a lot of stuff back. It was a massive reset button.
We now seem to be very scared of killing any trees, but if we want to be honest with ourselves, natural fire killed trees. It happened. Yes. That's natural.
I guess, Chad, we should say, too, the definition of kill when it comes to a tree, because we need to address that a little bit in this podcast, and maybe right now is, but a lot of times killing of a tree is maybe just top killing. I definitely think that the trees, when you're talking about some of these trees were killed, is, you know, maybe I believe that probably some of our big monster fires we had was when we created a tri-state drought, or we had a tri-state drought and a fire, lightning strike or something happened where fire just screamed across the landscape and trees were already extremely stressed, that probably killed some trees. But a lot of the fires we see today that landowners are using, even on mid-story trees, most likely, even trees out in, if you just had a couple trees out in the middle of a CRP field, or I guess that wouldn't qualify for CRP, but let's just say you've got a native warm season grass field and you've got trees out in the middle, you scream a fire through it, you probably just top kill those trees. And
I think that's a really important thing to note, is what you were describing, those conditions, when you're talking about landscape and tri-county regions, that's historical to specify, but like, when we're talking prescribed fire, we're talking wood lots, wood blocks. The area or the landscape these days is so broken up with crop fields, with developments,
overgrazed pastures,
overgrazed pastures, cool season pastures. Fire just can't even do those sort of things to the same degree that historically it could. But so that's encouraging. But at the same time, yeah. If you're not trained or don't know about prescribed fire, you could kill some trees. But again, what's the difference if you're going to kill with a chainsaw, or, you know, if you're going to die with a chainsaw, or it's going to die with fire? Dead is dead, or reset is reset.
Yeah, I think
you can't be scared of
those fires we're talking about that are like tri-state, the fires that scare us, the ones you see in recent years, Oklahoma and Kansas, parts of Texas, and then, of course, the ones California and
every
out west. Those are just major dry, humid, like the ones in Kansas, Oklahoma are major droughts in grasslands where it's just a doozy of a fire. People, Kansas East, it'd be hard for us to find those same conditions on the same site that people out there are dealing with. And then you go west, and the humidity's dropping into single digits. It's just, we won't see, very rarely will we see that anywhere Mississippi River East. And
yeah,
so you're just not going to have it very rarely, if ever. And but not to say you can't create a doozy of a fire if you aren't reading the conditions correctly. So, you know, this podcast, we're going to talk a little bit. We did a fire. I've already forgot those dates, fellas, but I think it was March 26th and March 30th of this year, 2020. And then we also did a fire April 12th of 2019. And so we kind of have a 13-month, a 13-month review of a fire, and then just a month and a half review on two fires. And there's a lot of things to observe, as well as there's some stuff that Matt and I have seen on recent consults from post-fire that are good reminders and good things to chat about to remind you guys about fire and how it can be used. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, brief awkward pause. Can't see each other, so it's like, who's going to talk next? So, you know, I guess I'll jump in and I'll say the fire we use, like anybody else, we've got a family farm, we lease a farm. Time is still limited for us. It's not, even though we're self-employed, we somehow manage to keep ourselves from having much free time to manage our own farm. So we're looking at it, how can we manage the most acres with a limited amount of time and make the biggest bang for our buck? And that's where prescribed fire comes in brilliantly. I mean, it's just amazing how well it works. And so obviously we're going to burn as much as we can. Every single year we're going to try to have some fires. So there's different regeneration levels, different vegetation levels with our across the farm. And then as well, just know that we're cleaning up the farm and we're keeping it in a much more manageable state. If you have a wood lot that doesn't see fire for a while and it starts filling up with woody saplings or invasive species, the chance of getting a beneficial fire through there just decreases with each year and with each year of growth. And so we're just keeping ours very productive. And then, you know, we're going to jump into one observation. We say the reset button so much, and the cover of this podcast will be a photo from a consult where one side of the little trail was not burned, the left side, and then the right side was burned last year. And you'll see a drastic difference in the green vegetation. Even though the vegetation hasn't changed a lot, it's a lot of white oak seedlings and white oak saplings. It's still, even though chances are these trees are relatively the same age, their growth is different. And on one side of the road that was not burned, the white oak trees, majority. Now there's American elm and some maples mixed in. But the white oak trees are anywhere from 7 to 12 feet tall, give or take. And that's where all the growth is. And it's just like, if it could hold your weight, you could just walk right across the 8 to 12 foot treetops and just walk right along, because that's where the energy from the sun is being captured and expressed with the vegetation. Now jump across the little trail and everything is about 1 foot tall or 2 foot tall, give or take. And what does that mean? That means that, well, from a timber standpoint, probably you're delaying the chance of seeing a marketable log out of any of those in the future if you continue to use prescribed fire. But if that's not part of your goals, and even a few of them slip through the cracks and are continued to not be, they weren't knocked back with a fire, but most of them were knocked back with a fire. And for me as a wildlife manager, I see now more resources being within reach of the wildlife. And I think that's what a lot of our goals are, is to try to put the most amount of resources within reach of wildlife, and specifically white-tailed deer. And so now we have more browse available. We're more suitable for cover, providing quality cover, because it's not already too far out of reach. And we're going to get more diversity because these little trees aren't completely filling up the canopy or mid-story to where there's a chance for some other more beneficial species to be growing in the understory. And so that was just a great reminder of the use of fire is a reset button to bring a lot of vegetation back down within reach of the wildlife.
I think, and you said it many times in that you have to have goals of a end result, the product of the fire. You have to have specific goals in mind before you drop that first flame. And every property and every fire and the timing of the fire and the conditions, let's just say you're in closed canopy versus a field, or pre-TSI, post-TSI fires, every single thing is different. And you have to be, you have to have, let's say, knowledge, almost foreshadowing, to know if I do this, then this will be my result. And but before that step is, you have to have the goal for that area and what that is. And you said goal. I think honestly, it's kind of a good segue into what were the goals for the fires that we set and why were they specifically that, and then tie into the result. But not everyone's goals are going to be the exact same for the fire. So it's not like, I guess you could look at the TSI level of intensity. You know, you refer to it as TSI, but the goal for each stand of TSI and everything is going to be completely different. And you have to look at prescribed fire the same way. What's the goal for the area? And then how do I use this tool to get me to that goal?
Yes.
I guess in order to, we probably ought to describe what we were burning in the first place to establish our goals. Because like the one unit was a large portion of it had been logged, and there were a lot of tops. We had quite a bit of growth coming in. This was more of a fuel reduction. Mm-hmm. We hadn't had a prescribed burn in there, and we were over, it was over 4 years, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe so. And it's also also important, you know, it's a west, mainly a west and southwest facing slope with a few little draws in there that might create some north facing, slightly northwest facing slopes.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's dominated with a west and southwest facing slope. Dry site.
And, I mean, this was the one we burned later. We burned it on March 30th. It was an area.
Which site we talking, Chad? Because there's two different ones. I'm talking about the one last year, April 12th.
I'm talking
burn.
About the one this
okay.
year.
Okay, so you're talking about,
It had been logged.
Yep.
Our main goal was to burn the part that had been logged and the south and west facing slopes.
Yeah.
We had, it was late enough that we had a lot of the spring ephemerals. A lot of our plants were already coming in, like the lady slipper, the yellow lady slipper that we had. So we really just lit the top of the ridge and let it back down the north facing slope. It was moist, a little wetter, a little greener. It didn't back down it a long ways, but we got the logging slash and a lot of that. We reduced the tops and reduced the fuel in that area. That was a major goal for that one.
Yes.
And then the other one that we burned this year has had a lot more timber work in it, a lot more TSI. We've opened up the canopy, and it's got a quite a bit of multiple arose response in it. So the goal on it was to top kill a lot of that response that we haven't had. It's about the same timing on burning, wasn't it? We hadn't burned the wooded portion in, was it 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, about 4 or 5 years, yep.
So it was in desperate need of it.
Yeah.
So that was the major goal on that, was the areas that we TSI'd to get a good burn through them to top kill all that stuff to set it back.
And when you say it really needed it, for everyone listening, really kind of paint the picture of what it was you're looking at. It's not just like trees, everyone, multi-floor rows, and there's a lot of other things growing after the TSI, but we're talking in some places some spice bush and shrubs, shoulder, head high.
We've had, and it was dominated by multi-floor rose, spice bush. If we're looking for diversity, that burn sets it back and gives everything a chance to grow instead of being dominated by 4 or 5 species.
Yeah.
A lot of this area had been dominated by spice bush, multi-floor rose, coral berry. A lot of plants like that had started to dominate in that, where it was partially shaded, some sun, where they could thrive. So our goal was to burn that to try to top kill all that stuff to allow a lot of our herbaceous plants to grow and thrive in amongst them.
Yeah.
Anything else you guys want to add to that?
You know, and I think that's a good reminder too of the importance of
of addressing native plants and plants that have adapted over time to the use of fire as a disturbance. And so when you have species that are introduced non-native, and specifically invasive species like autumn olive, bush honeysuckle, multiflora rose, those species don't handle fire real well. And so if you have them just starting to slowly integrate or show up on the landscape, you send in fire drastically sets those back. And so like the multiflora rose, you know, over time, I think people would be shocked to understand how bad it is for us, and how many we're dealing with. And so sending fire through and pushing our burn time back later into the window of time to where, you know, a lot of people are burning in January, February, early March, and we're trying to go late March or early April to when multiflora rose is already putting on leaves. Coral berries already putting on leaves, and of course coral berry or buck brush is native, but it can be a little bit aggressive for us. And so we're just waiting for some of these understory trees put on leaves and then hammer it with a fire and drastically set it back. So another big part of our overall goal is to not only increase diversity, but set back drastically a lot of those invasive species.
Yes, because a lot of those plants have, in where they've already put leaves on, they've expended a lot of energy putting those leaves on.
Yeah.
If we can burn them after that point, we've really stressed them.
Yeah, and it slows their response down so much that it gives the natives that are getting ready to pop a better chance of competing with them that growing season.
And that's a really important, I think, distinction of the timing of it, because you just have to understand plants and what they've done. It's been dormant season. They've held energy in their root system. Then they, like you said, Chad, pushed and used a lot of energy to leaf out completely before they really start getting aggressively photosynthesizing. So they don't have much energy, period, left in that plant. And if you top kill them, you constrict them, their leaves don't work anymore, and they're left like super, super, I don't want to say exhausted, but like they don't have the energy and the function. It gives those chance of the natives that we're looking to promote the ability to come back and hopefully overtake and shade out and then compete more aggressively or evenly with those species. And I think that oftentimes just not understood of like prescribed fire and how it works and why a January burn is going to be something completely different than for us this year, a late March burn. We would not have near that response with controlling or interfering with the production of multiflora rose in these woodlots. That ain't going to happen if you do it in January versus now. Timing is super important.
If you burn in January, you might get it hot enough to – it takes a hotter fire to set that multiflora rose back.
Well, you can top kill it. You'll top kill it in January.
I'm saying. You can, but it's going to take a hotter fire than when it's already got leaves on it.
Well, what I'm saying, though, is if you top kill it, though, it's going to respond better because it's like you've just cut it off. You know, you cut stuff off in the winter, and then the root systems push a lot of nutrients up, and they really jump up. If you can hit them later when they're leafed out, then you've really set them back even more. I mean, you go there and look now, and there are little stubs coming up. That's it.
Yeah. And then if they're really bad, it's a great time to, and you have time, it'd be a fine time to go hit it, spot treat it with herbicide, and be gone forever. But I feel that with fire integrated, that we'll eventually weed it out and not have to do that.
Yeah. And then I guess since we're talking goals, we might as well mention the other side that you're talking about, the burn from last year.
Yeah.
That we burned a little later once stuff had started to green up a little bit more. We didn't want as hot of a fire in that because we had a lot of logging slash in that on top of TSI slash. So it was more a fuel reduction, getting that stuff out so we didn't kill all of the trees that were residual and left.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, that was a 100-acre fire, give or take, and we burned April 12th, 2019, and you know, that was kind of a multiple step process where you go from closed canopy hardwoods to logged, so it's thin back, to over the course of the next several months more TSI, to where, you know, we're going from almost closed canopy to borderline really open woodland savanna setting in some instances, to where there's so much sunlight now and more fuel on the ground with the treetops, to where, man, it's drastically changed. So we knew we were going to get a major plant response.
And if you can burn at that time of the year, we set it back too, to where we were trying to burn to more stimulate the warm season grasses instead of the cool season stuff.
Yeah. And so when we burned,
knew they had growth in the crown, to where we were trying to stimulate them.
There was a lot of sedges that were popping, woodland sedges on that slope already. A lot of the cool season grasses that were shin high at that point last year on that slope and in that bottom, that transition going up to the upland.
Yeah. And so when we burned that one, you know, knowing the amount of disturbance with the logging, the skidder going up on the slope, we knew there was going to be some annuals that kicked up. Specifically common ragweed, giant ragweed down the bottoms, but more mare's tail. Of course, another native plant. And then, pokeweed. And so we knew
fireweed.
Fireweed was a big one. Yeah, I forgot about that one. We knew it was going to be a lot of annuals that first year, but knew that we wanted to burn to try to stimulate some more of those perennials. And so the first year, you know, if this is something that you guys are going through where our goal was more forage and more of a woodland setting. So instead of being a lot of leaf litter and sticks, it was, you know, all kinds of sedges and grasses, cool season, warm season grasses, shrubs, and then a lot of herbaceous plants. And, that first fire, there was a lot more herbaceous plants, so a lot more annuals that we mentioned earlier, but then also just overall, there was quite a bit of diversity, but there were some plant communities between last year and already this spring, big difference. And I think that's where something, depending on what your goals are, like I said, if you're looking for a lot of cover and a lot of food, then you need to get that canopy opened up, because we can go from east slope or north, kind of a northwest-ish slope. I guess there's not really any east slope, but that northwest and north slope compared to the west slope and the south slope, big difference in the vegetation and the plant communities. And, you know, with the fire, temperature and how well it carried, you could go from one site that's got decent amount of cover to another site that's going to need to be burned on a 3 to 4 year cycle to keep it to keep it from being almost too thick, if we're trying to look at it from a brood rearing or even a quail standpoint, because it could grow out of reach pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. I think that we really need to talk, and I know it's part of the conversation, but I think a good time to bring it into, as we've talked about timber harvest, TSI slash, and working in the timber, is talking about burning in the closed canopy timber situation, which I feel like is a very people hear fire and they're like, oh yeah, I'll burn, oh I'll burn, or I'm already burning, and it's great, I love it, it's cool. But I think it's really important to talk about like the overall benefits, and then too, again, the important part of it is the goal of what you're trying to accomplish if you're just burning in closed canopy timber.
Oh yeah, and I think that's been something that's evolved for me over time. Burning closed canopy forest in January, February is probably one of the easiest fires to practice. If it's just leaf litter, you're going to see just, you know, depending on the temperatures that day or the humidity that day, on average, you're going to probably see that 12-inch, 8 to 10-inch flame height just creeping through, depending on, you know, the slope as well. So you can create a very manageable fire with that closed canopy fire in January, February. But depending on your goals, and our goals have been, you know, increase diversity, increase, and by diversity, we're trying to increase the amount of plant growth in different types of plants on the forest floor. So we're providing more forage, we're providing more cover, we're providing not only forage to actually eat the plants, but more plants to attract insects, so we have more bugging or brood rearing type habitat within our woodlands, and so that's kind of our goals. We try to avoid the closed canopy park like setting, except for scattered areas on north slopes on the farm, because we're an upland site, an upland woodland site.
It's easy to fall into the, you know, I can remember the first burns that we did at the farm, like a long, long time ago. And, you know, it was closed canopy, very thick duff, and we burned them off, and we were so amazed at the stuff that grew. It's like, yeah. Oh man, there's ragweed growing in there. There's all kinds, this is awesome. But now you think back of what response we had.
Very limited.
Very, very limited benefit. Yeah, there was ragweed. How tall did it get? 6 inches?
Maybe, yeah. And I think...
Did it ever even put on a seed?
Probably not.
I don't think so.
No.
And that right there is exactly why, leading into the podcast, it was like, you have to go back and watch what happened. So it's what follows a prescribed fire that we're all trying to get to. But if we don't study it, you would potentially be still burning just closed canopy timber and not realizing that there is almost like a whole nother world, or like I would say, like burning closed canopy timber, if you're evaluating on a scale, grade scale, it's like a D+.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And you have so much more room to grow, and it's like people are like, wait, you want me to do what? Well, what about the tops? What about the slash? What about this? What about that? It's like, what are your goals? If they're to produce cover and a lot of food, you've got to have sunlight to do that, and fire's just a part of it. But if you don't go back and evaluate it and look, those species that you talk about, the ragweed, the burnweed, those are what you want, but you want them, again, at the right height, the right density to produce that awesome forage, not 6 inches. It'll be bigger.
Another thing I see from people a lot of time that aren't used to prescribed burning in this TSI stuff or in cedar slash, where you went in and cut a bunch of cedars out. People want to see it after one burn go back to what it looked like on the ground, open or closed canopy. They want to see it wide open again. It's like after one burn, you know what I'm saying? Where like, you cut all the cedars down, they want to then burn it and have all of that slash cleaned up.
Yeah, I want slash.
I don't want to. You hear people, well, leave it lay for 2 or 3 years so then you can burn it up. It's like, what's the point? I mean, yeah, I'm going to burn it up slowly. I'm not going to go in if I'm burning at that drastic stage where I want it dry enough to burn up the tops in 2 years. I'm probably going to be damaging some trees if I'm burning it that hot.
Yeah.
It's like, absolutely. I'm going to burn through. I'd like to go through the year after to reduce the fuel load in there so that I'm not burning an extremely hot fire.
And what you were saying there, Chad, too, is if your goal is to use prescribed fire to return it to look like closed canopy, then the fire, just keep it closed canopy if that's your goal. I mean, again, like if it's aesthetic is your goal with fire, then why use it?
Your goal
is to create better habitat.
Yeah, your goal in fire is to get an herbaceous plant response, and it's not going to look like closed canopy.
And it shouldn't.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
If you're burning closed canopy, you're going to get sassafras. You're going to get those shade tolerant species, and that's what you're going to get.
And that's if you even get those, depending on how shaded it is. I mean, that's one thing. I don't know if I would. If you ask me right now, what's the biggest thing you've learned in prescribed fire over the years? I would probably tell you that burning closed canopy forest is a waste of time and waste of a resource. For the simple fact that sometimes, let's say, if you're a landowner and your goal is more cover within the more cover and more food within the understory, I don't know what would bring. I don't know which one would bring more food, but I do know that you're probably going to have, over the course of 5 years, more cover in a unburned area than one that's burned every 3 to 4 years, because you think about that window of time where, let's say you burn in January or February. So if you burn in February, you have to wait for spring green up. And for our neck of the woods, that could be late March, early April to mid-April. So you have February through the month of, or however many weeks of March to early April. That's your window of time. Could be 2 weeks. It could be 6 weeks before you really start seeing that flush of green vegetation. And then once the trees grow leaves, now you have a shaded understory to where the growth drastically slows down. And so if you're looking for
screeching salt.
Yeah, if you're looking for that cover, and you're talking up to 4 foot, it takes several years for you to get to 4 foot in vegetation that a vegetation that's providing much benefit in an understory of closed canopy forest. And so if you're burning it every couple of years, you're kind of stacking the odds against you if you're looking for a lot of cover and forage. And so, you know, you will get that immediate flush from the fire, so you're going to get that food source, but you're certainly not going to get much of a cover aspect. And so that's why if you're wanting to burn some woodlands, you better fire up chainsaw first or start doing some timber work, because you're gonna greatly increase your benefits by doing so.
Yeah. On the flip side of that, you have some of our stuff where we've TSI'd it and we've cut it, we've burned, we have stump sprouts that generally in that 3 to 4 year span, they end up growing probably out of the reach of the deer. We run a fire through it. It sets it all back to the start again.
Yep.
And all we've had to do is run a fire through it.
Yep.
We didn't treat I rarely treat stumps unless there's something we really don't want.
Yeah.
I generally count on the fire setting it back.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Takes too long to go in there with chemicals all behind.
So, talking a little bit about some observations you made today, where you had a north and a northwest facing slope, elevator ridge. It's near a stand we call Dahlhart, where, you know, spice bush was a very common understory shrub that almost a little bit aggressive, where we hadn't burned it in several years, and it was kind of the point where it was like, I sure hope the fire sets that back.
Yeah, and it was right at that like leaf out / blooming stage when we burned it. Because remember, we went in and like you could see some of them that the tops hadn't been top killed and they were still blooming yellow, and then others where you could see it had singed them and they were brown. And that's what I went in today, and we had, I'd say at least probably 75% of them were top killed.
Wow.
There's still some standing where the fire didn't get as hot.
Which is fine, because they're important.
We don't want to knock them out.
Yeah.
I mean, we keep some, and that's the goal of the whole thing. This, I guess I should say too, this burn, we had a little higher humidity than we honestly wanted when we burned this. I mean, when we started, it really didn't burn the greatest. We actually stopped and went and walked around and shed hunted for a while because it wasn't pulling in very well. But I mean, the areas that we really wanted to burn pretty decent. And so I'm just telling you guys, we probably knocked back. I'd say we actually killed probably close to 50% of the cedars in an area I hadn't cut the cedars yet.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think
that'll save some work.
Yeah. I know, you know, I got asked this question the other day, how hot of a fire does it have to be to kill cedars when they're over 5 foot tall? And I said, yeah, it really depends on the current situation and the circumstances, because on the fire that we did in March 26th of this year, 2020, there was some later in the day, towards the tail end of the fire unit, there was a cedar that was every bit of 10 foot, if not 12 foot tall, that's completely, completely orange and dead. And the fire really wasn't that hot, but, you know, during that time of the year, I think even the cedars are starting to do some stuff to where I think they're more susceptible to being scorched. And,
and
we set them back.
I guess
we didn't
time.
Even set them back. We killed them.
It's
killed
a good
them.
Time to also mention, I think a lot of people are hesitant to use anything but like backing fires.
Yeah.
But the area I'm talking about with killing the cedars, that was an area that's a south facing slope that we wanted a hot fire. And I told Matt when we met up, I'm like, drop down the hill, light a head fire across that, let it eat.
And it's steep. And I was walking pretty much the bottom. And I had the drip torch at my hip, and it was pretty much touching the ground. It was that steep of a slope. So it was at the bottom, and it went right up that slope quickly.
Yeah, and that was the goal there. It was a south-facing, west-facing slope. We wanted a good head fire to rip up over the top. I mean, that's the result that we wanted. We got from that head fire.
I think that it's common knowledge, but it's almost difficult to talk about for a lot of people, but it makes sense when you say it. If your timber is 100% closed canopy, it's wide open, and you're like, I want cover, well, you have to do some drastic things in that timber to make it produce cover. You have to cut trees. You have to get sunlight in. And we're talking here, burning will continue and perpetuate that awesome cover and produce more food in that area. But you're not going to do it just by backing fire every 3 years in closed canopy timber. You're never going to get there. And so if you're trying to make your farm have more cover, be aggressive. You're going to have to be. And if we're coming there to the property, be prepared, because we're probably going to recommend some drastic things. But that's your goal. That's the whole important part of identifying the goal in the front end, because if you don't know what your goal is and you hear we got to reduce the canopy by 40-50% and then burn and maybe do some head firing or maybe do this, maybe do that on firing techniques, that's going to sound crazy. But you have to remember, if all that you have are leaves and sticks and the occasional 10 foot tall regenerating elm, maple dotted throughout your timber, which a lot of people, that's the situation you're in. If you want to turn that into cover, you better be ready, because that's, I mean, it's going to take a lot. It's going to take work.
Yeah. And there was a large stretch of that that you lit a head fire through that we've cut a lot of trees on. I mean, that south facing slope, we've cut some pretty good openings where it was a lot of just junk, like non-marketable timber. It was a lot of blackjack, a lot of stuff that will stump sprout back in places. But
I was climbing over, stepping over logs, lighting fire. Like it's not a walk in a park kind of situation. But again, do you want it to be a walk in the park situation? Again, you're looking for cover. You're looking for food. You're looking for stuff that's growing up to 6 foot tall. That's what you want. It's briary, it's thick, it's shrubby, and guess what? It's going to stay like that. It might be reset, but it's going to stay like that for at least another 4 or 5 years because it got another disturbance.
Absolutely, for sure. I think there's so much to be learned and said. I mean, we could do podcast after podcast after podcast about plant response. But for us, it's just a good time to sit back because we've all looked at some post-fire over the last few weeks and gone, man, there's so many different things to learn about, to see. And just in the one, just driving down the gravel road today and seeing a north slope of the March 26th fire, you could see patches where Chad and people that have listened that were part of our QDMA branch field day a couple years ago, they stood in one of these areas that you TSI'd, and you could just see a green understory and then go 50 yards where no cutting had been done and the very little plant growth. And fire happened the same day, and it just didn't have the plant growth because it was shaded in no time. And I think that's just a good reminder to people that understand your goals. Make sure that your goals, write down your goals before you ever do anything, because it's good to remind ourselves of what we're working for. But at the same time, then look at some of your most common practices or common things that you do on your farm or your most time-consuming events and see if those are in line with your goals. Because if they're not, it's time to change your what you're doing with your time on your farm. And if your goals are increase diversity and create a mosaic of different plant communities, and your burn timing is, or your burn units are in February, or they're in closed canopy forest, then it's probably time to change up what you're doing. Maybe it's a good time to spend 2 years doing TSI and not burning those same woodlots over and over that are closed canopy. And one thing before I forget, we need to mention too is the importance of breaking up fire units. If you have larger fire units and time allows, try to bust those up and do more small units versus big ones. And you know, some of ours are bigger, like this about 100-acre one, because it's an entire slope and there's not really any good trails to break that up. But over time, we're going to have to find a place to create it to where we can make maybe two units on that one. And then, so when we do have a burn day, instead of devoting the entire day to that 100 acres, maybe we can do part of burn one of them and then bounce over to another part of the farm and burn another 30 acres or so, to where there's two different parts of the farm that are being burned.
I think that's definitely important. And Chad and I were talking about that actually on my drive up to Minnesota today, is just breaking up units. If you have that option, it's more work maybe to maintain more fire line itself, but the value of breaking up units and having this quality cover across a farm and the varying heights and degrees and vegetation response is so critical to accomplishing goals of whether it's fawn recruitment, increasing that, or brood rearing capabilities, better nesting cover, just more forage spread out across a property. Breaking up units is definitely certainly a wise thing to do. The other thing I think that is also important to mention, and it goes right in line with breaking up units, because again, we're wanting species diversity as well as diversity in heights of cover across a farm. And I've gotten this a couple times from people who have burned or sent, like, hey, how'd it go? Like, how'd it burn? Not every fire is going to burn black to black from edge to edge, or the humidity is going to be absolutely perfect. Sometimes the cards you're dealt with is just mediocre fire weather. But know that some fire with sunlight is a lot better than no fire, number one. And then number two is patchy burns probably means that there's diversity then still within that unit. Maybe you have some more annual bases and then you didn't top kill 50% of the shrubs. Maybe you only top killed 30% of them that were growing there. Well, that's okay. Maybe next time you'll get them, but now you've got some annual vegetation species growing in close proximity to shrubby cover with a great canopy. Now that's probably great for different stages of poults, or great for shading or loafing cover, maybe for quail during the summer. But patchy burns isn't a bad thing.
That's something I see with work a lot of times, is it's easy to fall into the mentality of wanting to see every bit of leaf litter, every bit of fuel consumed in a burn. Mm-hmm. No matter how big the burn is, you want to see it completely blacked off. A lot of people fall into that mindset of, well, it didn't burn everything. It just didn't burn what I wanted. It's like, a lot of times, and that's a kind of a benefit to the timing of our burn, a lot of times the bottom ground is a little greener. There's a little bit of greening. Cool season, or some of our cool season natives, they've greened up. You don't see it burn as well in the bottoms. Well, sometimes that ends up being where a turkey nests. Some of these smaller areas of our burns that are 100 acres, the turkeys are using the whole thing. They may nest in that because they're feeding around. Well, then what's the benefit to them nesting within that burn? There's great brooding areas throughout that burn as well.
Directly adjacent.
You've got that right there, right in the middle of it. And that's the same with like a growing season burn. I mean, we didn't mention that, but I burned, it may have been an acre or two, but this one unit I burned, there was an area in there that I tried to growing season burn last year. And kind of lost my window, but I burned maybe an acre or two within that burn unit. I had growing season burn, and it creeped around and it top killed some stuff, but that's just more diversity within that burn. That's another way to break up your burns, is if you have areas within that, you can do a growing season burn within that burn unit the year before.
Yeah, and
that
and
area
yours,
didn't burn hardly at all.
You burned, basically it was hot enough to burn right at the edge of the food plot, but once you started getting into big trees, it just trickled out. And
yeah,
so
guess
it just
what? Closed that's a canopy.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a very forb heavy area now this year because you stimulated mm-hmm. forbs with that fire rather than grasses.
I think that oftentimes it's hard to look past trees and think that there's something else available on a site than just trees. It's like, just because those trees have been growing there for the last 60 to 80 years doesn't mean that let's say 5-10 acres can't be something else, or shouldn't be something else, or shouldn't be some trees and a lot of herbaceous understory and shrubs underneath of it. We get so stuck in our ways once we've seen a farm or property over and over and over, and if you're missing out on those awesome species and forbs. And if you listen to the other podcast recorded with Kip Adams this week, you can learn why those forbs are so critical. And that's exactly what fire is helping to stimulate, the timing of fire. But if you just don't have that on a property, I guess going back to the scale of or grade, it's probably an F. You got to have those. Like, they're so critical. Well, don't look at timber and just put it. Don't just put it in that like box of, oh, it's timber. It's just it's gonna stay timber. It does not have to stay timber.
And I guess another word of advice on post burn is don't look at the response you have in the first year and think that's all you're going to get.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The hillside that we burned last year, we spent, it was about all summer. Every time we went by, we found a new plant. It seemed like almost every time one of us went through there, we're like, hey, look what I found on the hillside. This was from the gravel road.
Yeah. Basically this plant is seeding out now and we can identify it or it's visual now.
It's like, oh, this one's blooming. Hey, look at this. Hey, I found this. Hey, I found this. Well, then you could very easily think, well, that's what we're going to get. Well, all of a sudden this year now, there's like wild bergamot growing in places that it wasn't there last year. It's like all of a sudden another year post-burn, all these other responses are coming in now. We're seeing other plants where it's like you're even anxious for the next burn that we do on that to see the response of what other plants come back.
I think I know someone's out there probably wondering this because we get the question a lot, and we kind of mentioned it, and I'll just throw it out there to you guys and say, what do you think, or what would you recommend? But someone's probably saying, okay, guys, I got closed canopy, I want to burn, but I haven't done TSI yet. Is it better to burn and then like burn next spring, early spring, and then right immediately after I do the burn, start doing TSI, or should I do TSI and like through this next year and burn? Like what is the difference? Because I think a lot of people are worried about the slash and burning with that new slash on the ground. And
we may even have different answers on this one, but Matt, Chad, you can share your answer and then I'll share mine.
In my mind, if they've never burned, there's going to be quite the fuel load there, I would want to burn first, not just to reduce the fuel load. But if you're going to then go in after the burn and start doing your TSI, it's going to be easier to get around. Yeah. I mean, that's what we do at work. Like, we generally, before we go in to do timber marking on a watershed, it's generally we do our prescribed burns first. Mm-hmm. Because it's easier to get around in them. Yeah. After a burn.
The only thing I would be cautious of is if you're doing your burn during dormant season, January, February, to not go in April or even March, depending on your location, and do a whole bunch of TSI right during spring green up. That's kind of the time of the year I don't want to really hammer away and be doing a bunch of that.
No.
So that would be my only thing. But at the same time, you know, really depends on time, because some people buy their farm and they're ambitious to get things done. So I would agree with Chad in that man, it's so much easier to do TSI if it's a freshly burned area, that's for sure. So anyway, that would be my answer as well.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I know some of that thing because we get that one a lot, or it comes up a lot on consultations. Is it like the chicken comes first?
Yeah. And I think there's another thing to note too, though, is like, let's just say you do TSI in January or December and January, and then you burn in February, March. A lot of those trees that you cut most likely aren't going to burn up that much anyway. It's
still
not like
really green.
Yeah, they're still kind of limber and they just aren't as, they haven't dried out laying on the ground as much. And so I wouldn't be opposed to that way either, because it's not like they have a whole bunch of leaves. Now, what I would be cautious of is if you do a bunch of TSI when the leaves are on the trees,
mm-hmm.
and then you drop them and then try to burn that next winter, that could create some major, major issues, especially if you never burned before. That's yes. A big thing I would avoid.
Because everyone, that canopy is still, it's just a bunch of dried leaves on
top
of that canopy.
It get hot. It gets so hot.
The fire hits those canopies.
Yeah.
It's gonna go up a little bit. So
yeah.
I'm definitely in agreement kind of with you guys on the novice burning, trying to get into it, knowing sunlight's important, that kind of two-step phase burn and immediately come in and start opening up the canopy would be valuable.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap this podcast up. I was hoping for 30 minutes and we end up going 100 or 1 hour and 2 minutes. so tell you a little bit about prescribed fire. I know there's many, many more podcasts coming on prescribed fire and results and observations we've made as we continue to restore woodlands and savannas and glades and all kinds of wonderful places in the Ozarks. So, and across the country, I guess, with working with our clients. So, if you guys have any questions about having us out, shoot us an email or get on to landandlegacy.tv, check out the consultation tab, and send us an email at info@landandlegacy.tv. We'd be glad to help you. Matt, you're in Minnesota, which I think is our 27th yeah. state that we've been in now, fourth year or 28th state, something like that. I know Kyle will be in Florida next month. And so that'll be our 28th or 29th state. So we've been a lot of places. So, guys, if you're listening, if you're within earshot, we've probably been to your area. And hopefully we can help you at some point in the future. Because really at the end of this, we're hoping that you can reach your goals with the least amount of money spent possible in the quickest amount of time. That's the dream, and I believe we've found some ways to help you get there.
Definitely. Anyway. Safe travels on your trip.
Yeah, same to you.
Chad, have fun. I don't know what you're doing, but have fun.
I'm probably going to end up planting.
There you go.
Oh, hey, that'll be all right.
Yeah.
Keep us updated.
It is food plot season still. All right, guys. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week.